I must say that it's walking into this huge building, I was wondering what awaits me. And I know there's a lot of businesses in the world. I know there's a lot of things that are going on. A lot of people are making a lot of money. Probably some things that are not so good going on as well. But to come down here and to see what I see, and I'm not just talking about the rooms and the spaciousness and the beauty of, but to see this, this is truly a testimony to what Klal Yisrael is all about. You know, we've been through much, and that is maybe the greatest understatement. We've been through everything. There is no nation on the face of the earth that has endured so much torment and torture and suffering as the Klal Yisrael. And yet, here we are today, close to 2,000 years after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, close to over 3,300, it's actually 3,329 years since Maimon Har Sinai, about 4,000 years since Avraham Avinu. And look, look what's going on. Hasn't changed. Same Torah, same mitzvahs, same dedication to the Torah and mitzvahs as we had throughout our history. And this is the last 2,000 years without a place to hang our hats, no homeland, being dispersed throughout all of the Dalit Kanfeis Ha'oretz, literally. You can find Jews any place on this planet, under some of the most adverse conditions. By all laws of nature, what's going on here today cannot exist. Cannot. It's impossible. It is the impossible. That here we should be sitting here today, studying. Here, look what I have here. I have the same Sefer Torah, the same Chumash that was given to me, taught to me, dictated to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai 3,329 years ago. You're studying it and observing the mitzvahs and dedicating our lives to the same traditions that have been part of our people since the time of Avraham Avinu. There's nothing like this in the world. It's incomprehensible. In fact, excuse me, it said that they once confronted Albert Einstein, who in his time was considered the genius of his secular generation. And they asked him, Professor Einstein, if you could meet a figure of history, someone from way back, who would you like to talk to? And they thought he would maybe say one of the great scientists who preceded him, Galileo or Copernicus or Newton or who knows who. And Einstein said very quickly, very simply, I would want to meet Moses. And I would want to ask him if he really believed that thousands of years later, his people would still be studying the same law that he delivered to them, would still be observing the same commandments that were instituted through that law, through that Torah at the time. That to him was mind-boggling. How there could be such a thing. It was the greatest, the most amazing, the most unbelievable phenomenon in all of history, in all of the history of science. And there have been so many discoveries and changes and inventions, but this was mind-boggling. In fact, the Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his Nahakdoma to his Siddur, he swears by his life. He says, Chai Nafshi, I swear by my life that the miracles that have allowed and assured the survival of the Klal Yisrael and the survival of the Torah together with Klal Yisrael are greater than all of the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kriyas Yamsuf. We learned about Yetzias Mitzrayim. We remember it every day. We know what happened on the Yamsuf, the most unbelievable, mind-boggling, earth-shattering miracles. And yet, this miracle that we're experiencing today, and it's not just here, it's in communities all over the country and all over the world. It's in some of the most unlikely places that no one would have imagined. Such a commitment, such a dedication, such a mesiras nefesh for that same Torah for thousands of years is truly the greatest miracle in all of our history and something that we all should be proud and privileged to be a part of. And therefore, every time, and I travel a bit, and wherever I go and I see communities like this and groups like this, I'm just never cease to be amazed and reinforced in who we are and what we are and how much that we have to be proud of. But that's not why I'm here today. I'm here today on a mission, and I would like to share that mission with you. Forgive me, but I'm here on a mission. My purpose in being in Dallas is to, I have an organization. I raise a lot of money each year for this organization. And the purpose of the organization is to eradicate cockroaches in Jewish communities throughout the country. What are you smiling about? That's my purpose, to eradicate. Eradicate means to get rid of. Okay, the cockroaches, you know what that is, even if you don't know, it's not so nice. And throughout the Jewish communities, and that's where I travel. I raised $3 million last year for my organization just to eradicate cockroaches. Most of it goes to my pocket, but that's besides the point. You don't have to tell anybody, okay? Now, that gives me energy. I wake up in the morning. Wow, I have a goal. I have a purpose. I'm going to raise maybe $10,000 today and eradicate 250 cockroaches. Wow, I got purpose. One day, I looked in the mirror and I saw this old man. But then I said, you know, maybe at my stage in life, maybe with the level of capability that I have, which is not great, but, you know, a little bit, I could be doing something more than eradicating cockroaches. And I started to wonder, like, that's my purpose, eradicating cockroaches. Maybe I could eradicate mice or rats or maybe even do something positive or constructive in the world. And I began to feel very disenfranchised, very down, very wasted, very like, what in the world are you doing? The money is good. Again, the pockets are full, but like, for what? No sense of purpose that makes any sense. So I thought, I'm going to choose a new purpose. I'm going to find something else. I'm going to really search around, do a lot of research, and come up with something that really gives me a sense of purpose in life. And after looking and looking and looking and making many different, analyzing many different options, I came to the conclusion that that's not enough. I want to know the purpose for which I was put into this world in the first place. Because that's the thing that would mean the most to me. That's the thing that would make my life worth living. I know my purpose. Because, for example, if I were to believe that the purpose of this piece of technology, which costs a lot of money, is to scratch my head, it would be quite a waste of the investment to purchase such technology. And then I realized that I have to find out what the true purpose for my existence is. And then I realized that there's only one way to know the purpose, and that's to consult the manufacturer. And then I realized I have to find out if the manufacturer will talk to me. Now, in the case of Sony, they refused to talk to me. So now what do I do? The manufacturer won't talk to me. I want to know the true purpose for this investment that I made, and I'm at a loss. What should I do? Then I had this brilliant idea. Guess what it was? Google. I'm from a different generation. You consult the manual. Google Schmoogle. You consult the manual. So I looked for the manual, which I didn't even pay attention to originally because I thought that I purchased a head scratcher. And I find the manual, and the manufacturer, being the only one who knows the true purpose for which he manufactured this piece of technology, now tells me its true purpose, how to use it, what it's doing here, and I felt so much better. Why do I tell you my story, my life story? I'll tell you why, for two reasons. Number one, forgive me. Number one, we live in a very strange world. I believe, I haven't done a study, but I believe that more money is spent in our society on the pursuit of happiness than anything else in human history. There's more books written. There's more seminars. There's more... What people don't do to try to find happiness. And there's even a whole profession of mental health professionals all trying to help people who are depressed and who don't feel good about themselves and so forth, trying to be happy. So it is the industry of choice of civilization in the world which we live. And then I looked at something else and I was shocked by the contrast. If you look at the suicide rates, if you look at the substance abuse rates, even if you just look at the rates that mental health professionals charge for 45 minutes, it's shocking. The whole world is looking for happiness, and nobody seems to have found it. And I couldn't get over that contradiction. Everyone's pursuit of happiness, pursuit of happiness. It's guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, but nobody could care about that. But we're searching and searching and searching and searching. We spend money, we spend time, we spend effort the whole life looking for happiness, and we don't seem to be finding it as a society. Why? And I was hard-pressed to figure out the answer. Finally, one day, the answer hit me. And I believe I have the answer I'd like to share with you. We don't know what happiness is. If you don't know what you're looking for, you could trip on it and you wouldn't even notice it. What's happiness? Of course the whole world wants to be happy. Sounds like the most important thing, and it is. Or maybe it is. But it's certainly part of it. And of course everybody is looking for it. But if you don't know what you're looking for, forget it. Don't even try. Because even if you get it, you won't know what you got. You won't know what you had. You'll still be looking. So we need a definition of happiness. We're very fortunate. We're very fortunate. We have a Torah that not only has the ultimate wisdom of the universe, everything. It's the wisdom of the Creator Himself. It's the blueprint upon which by which He created the world. Everything in this world exists according to the blueprint, just like in the blueprints of this building. Every piece of development and everything behind the walls and in the ceiling and all over exists because it was part of the blueprint and it's built upon the plan of that blueprint. But besides that, we have a language which also reveals to us secrets. The secrets of humanity, the secrets of the universe are revealed in the Lashon HaKodesh. Do you know Lashon HaKodesh is different from every language? Every language, words have been chosen by what we call convention. That people decided, maybe they had a convention, maybe they didn't, but they decided to call this a table. There's nothing table-y about it. There's nothing watery about it, although you think there is. It's convention. Convention. A hat is a hat because people decided to call it that. And this is, I don't know what it's called exactly, but in Yiddish I know what it's called. But anyway, people decided to call it that. All languages are arbitrary, just words that were chosen for... Some say that the language is originated from Lashon HaKodesh, but that be that as it may. Not so Lashon HaKodesh. In Lashon HaKodesh, every time you see a three-letter Shoresh, it implants meaning in that word. And each word carries within it the secret of what it means. The word itself describes the essence of the concept that it is used for. For example, what's the word for scale? What's that? Mosnayim. Okay. What's the word for ear? Is that the same shoresh?
Yeah.
Why?
Because the root word.
Because what?
The shoresh is the same.
Yeah, the shoresh is the same, but why?
Didn't you have vowels in your ear?
What's that? Oh, that's right. Ozen, everyone knows, it's the middle ear that's the organ that's responsible for balance. So Aleph, Zayin, Nun, that shoresh means balance. And whether it's this kind of balance or this kind of balance, that's what it is. It's all about the Lashon Kodesh, the three-letter root describes the essence of the word. Now, let's find the word for happiness and let's see what the Shoresh teaches us. David HaMelech, in Kapitel Chof Zayin, said, Achas shoalti meyes Hashem oiso avakesh, shifti meyes Hashem kol yimei chayai. David HaMelech had one request, to sit bebeis Hashem. To sit in the house of Hashem, kol yemei chayai, lachzeis benoyam Hashem, to bask in that countenance of Hashem. What did David HaMelech tell us about one who sits in the house of Hashem? What did David HaMelech say about someone who sits in the house of Hashem? Come on, you know it. What's that?
Protection.
What?
They'll be happy.
No, but where? To what David HaMelech said. That's what you say. What did David HaMelech say? What? What? That's interesting. I didn't think of that one. Samachti ba'omrim li beis Hashem nelech. So that the beis Hashem is associated with simcha. But that doesn't help me. That doesn't help me, but that's true. Definitely good. What did he say about one who sits in beis Hashem? It's a very simple pasuk. Everybody knows it. Did that mincha? Maybe you know.
It's
Ashrei. Yoshrei beisecha. Happy. Ashrei is the one who sits for Beis Hashem. That's what we say to Hashem. Ashrei Yoshvei Beis Echo. So again, David HaMelech's one request, the thing he wanted more in life than anything else, is to sit for Beis Hashem. David HaMelech said the one who sits for Beis Hashem is Osher, happy. Aleph, Shin, Reish is the Sherish. Do you know what that Sherish means?
Rich.
What? What's that? Aleph, Shin, what's that? Ayin? No, with an ayin. I'll tell you a story with an ayin. You mentioned ayin. Yeah, listen to this. Many years ago, I went to Israel, to Yerushalayim, for a date. And I met a girl. Well, at the time, she didn't speak much English, and I didn't speak much Hebrew. And we got along great the first dates until we learned the language was mamish. Can't imagine. About the second or third date, I asked her, what do you want out of life? You know, get to know a person. What do you want out of life? So she said to me, "Ani rotza liot meusheret." I thought she wanted my money. I was almost out of there until I figured out that there's a difference between osher with an ayin and osher with an aleph. I was talking ashrei yoshvei beisecho with an aleph. That's happiness, not money. Money doesn't bring happiness, and don't let anybody fool you to think that it does. In fact, money sometimes is antithetical. That means the opposite of happiness, but let's leave that for now. Okay, so now, osher is a very high form of happiness. What does that sherish mean? That sherish of osher means, it comes from the word ishur, validation. You know what happiness is? Validation, feeling good about myself. Very simple formula. A person who feels good about himself or herself, that person is happy. That's what osher is. That's what that three-letter shoresh represents. So if I feel good about myself, then I'm happy. Let me ask you now, let's go back to my life's crisis and ask you a question. What ingredient would you say, if it's lacking, can almost assure that I can't feel good about myself?
Self-esteem.
What?
Self-esteem.
Well, self-esteem is maybe feeling good about yourself. What ingredient? An ingredient that if I'm missing this ingredient, if I don't have this in my life, think about the discussion that we had before. If I don't have this in my life, I can't possibly feel good about myself. One word.
Happiness.
What's that? Hashem, Torah, those are always the right answers, but let's
yourself.
Get a little more specific, okay? What?
Yourself.
Yourself, that's also good. Come, what?
Purpose!
How in the world can I feel good about myself if I have no purpose in being here? I have no purpose. What am I doing? I do! Eradicating cockroaches. Yeah! But that purpose. So cheap. So stupid. Money's good. But so stupid. Why? I want to know my purpose. I want to know a purpose that's matim, that's befitting a person of my kriches, of my capabilities, and I want to know the true purpose for which I was put in this world. And only that can assure my happiness. Because if I don't have a sense of my true purpose in life, I am cursed to be miserable. How can I feel good about myself? Do you know that any good mental health professional will tell you that if someone walks in and says, "Doc, I got no point in living, I got no purpose in being here," the suicide watch should begin immediately, because that person is in danger. Have no purpose. And the world that runs around today with a lack of purpose, that's a world in trouble. That's why there's so much trouble in the world. That's why people are so miserable. They don't have a sense of purpose. They don't feel good about themselves if they don't have a sense of purpose. What's their purpose? I want to tell you something else. Up until about 170, I don't know exactly, years ago, the situation was much better. Because everybody knew that there was a purpose. Why? Because there was a creator. And if there's a creator, a creative act, by definition, has purpose. Otherwise, why does a creator do a creative act unless it's for a purpose? Now, many people, most people, didn't know what that purpose was. But they had something to hope for. Let's search. Let's go to India. Let's go to China. Let's go here. Let's go there. We'll search the world to try to find out our purpose. Okay? Maybe we'll find it. Maybe we won't. Many people peeked into Judaism to see because it sounded like the Jews, they had something special. But everybody at least had hope that there was a purpose in life because there was a creation. Came along some guy whose name will not be mentioned. And he came up with this theory that we're all a bunch of accidents. That's basically, I don't know what science you learn here, but that's distilled to its simplest form. That's what it is. We're all a bunch of accidents. Everybody is here by accident. Accidents? Do you know the definition of an accident? A purposeless act. That's right. Happened with no purpose. Just happened. I'm an accident? I have no purpose? Miserable. How can I feel good about myself? What's my life worth? So the world today is in big trouble. Because those people who have been influenced by this philosophy of accidentology, that we came about by accidents, they're finished. They're doomed. An accident has no purpose, no validation, no feeling good about yourself, no happiness, no point to the whole thing. Ashreinu matoiv chelkeinu. We are so fortunate. Not only do we know that we have a purpose, not only do we know that we were created and therefore we have a purpose, not only was that purpose revealed to us in a manual that we have, but the manual was given in front of Am Vo'edo, in front of the entire Jewish nation, in front of a few million people, hearing the manufacturer, forgive me, in his own voice, identifying himself and saying, hey guys, remember me, all those miracles that happened, Yitzias Mitzrayim, Kriyas Yamsuf, c'est moi, that's me, I'm the one that did that. And now I'm going to tell you, as your creator, who showed his control over Chukai Shamayim Ba'oretz and all of creation, now I am going to share with you the purpose of creation. And I'm doing this publicly, so there'll be no doubt about it. Nobody will have any questions. Nobody will think, well, how do I know for sure this, that? No, it's a public act. It's public history. It's recorded in history. Not only is it recorded in history, but no nation in history has ever mimicked such an event. Interesting, they could have learned to mimic everything from us. This one they never copied. All religions talk about private revelations, not public. And I think the reason is obvious. You can't get away with such a claim unless it actually happened. Because people say, I saw it. You saw it. You witnessed it. No, we didn't. No, no such thing. And this document was not only taught to us by the Creator himself, but in the same public event, he spoke to us, to the entire nation, and appointed Moshe Rabbeinu as the official Novi, as the official spokesman. As the Pasuk says, Bavur Yishma Ha'om Bedabri Imoch, the people here know, not only did they hear me speak and tell them what my purpose of my creation, but they heard me appoint Moshe Rabbeinu as the official spokesman. And therefore, when Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down verbatim, as dictated to him by the Creator himself, every word that Hashem dictated to him in the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, then we know that Hashem himself told us that Moshe Rabbeinu is my authorized spokesman, and you can rely on him, Moshe mipi hagvura, as if you heard it all directly from him. In fact, the whole reason they didn't hear it directly from him is that they said they don't want to hear it directly from him. They were afraid. They said, al yedaber imonu, al yedaber ato imonu, penomus, and Moshe should speak to us and he'll tell us. So That's it. So we have the unique, the most unique opportunity for happiness in the world. We know what it is. The Lashon HaKodesh teaches it to us. We know that it's about osher, that it's about validation. It's about feeling good about ourselves. We know that feeling good about ourselves requires purpose. And we know that there's a creator. Therefore, there must be purpose. And we know the creator revealed the manual to us, which tells us the purpose. He revealed it in a way that there should be no room for question and no room for doubt because of millions of people. And everybody knows that it was done. And everybody knows that Moshe Rabbeinu was publicly appointed as the ultimate spokesman. And there's something else that we know. We know that our Torah was handed down from generation to generation accurately. Because the system of transmission is mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. It was written down. Each Shevet received their own Sefer Torah. The original Sefer Torah, Teras Moshe, that he wrote himself, well, he wrote them all, but the first one that he wrote was put away in the Oroin and was preserved from generation to generation as the test texts, as the texts that we can compare. Anytime there might be any question, we look at the original texts. These texts were passed down from one generation to the next. And to this very day, 3,329, well, count the 40 years of the Midbar, so 3,329 minus 40, I don't know, that's higher mathematics for me, but whatever it is, that for that amount of time, we know that this Torah was passed on from one generation to the next, accurately. Read publicly, every Shabbos read publicly, three times a week, three times besides the Shabbos. Studied in every family, every father having a responsibility to teach it to his son. And not only were we studying the same text, but we were living by that text. Because the text makes many demands of us. And all of those demands were part of our lifestyle. So here we have a text which carries a message. And we have a lifestyle which is passed on from generation to generation. Each one saw the lifestyle of their parents and their grandparents. They saw their sukkah, they saw their mezuzah, they saw their tefillah, they saw their tzitzis, they saw their Shabbos. And passed on from generation to generation to this very day. And we find that no matter we look in the world, no matter where we look, the Jews came back from Teman, who were separated for maybe 1,500 or more years, and they come back to Eretz Yisrael, and they bring the Sifrei Torah, and they are identical to the Sifrei Torah that the European Jews had, who had no contact with the people in Teman for so many years. I think there's one difference of an aleph and a hey in one word, and it doesn't change the meaning or the pronunciation. Unbelievable. In fact, there's a rabbi in Hollywood, Florida. His name is Rabbi Davis. I think he's retired now. He once told me the following. He said that when he brings, every couple of years, he used to bring a sofer, a chassidish sofer, to correct his Sifrei Torah. So the sofer told him that when he comes down to Hollywood, Florida, so he says the rabbi in the Reformed Temple also invites him to check his scrolls. And the sofer said, I asked this rabbi, why do you need a guy like me? Like, why are you interested in checking the scrolls and fixing them and making sure that they remain accurate and identical with everything else? So the Reform rabbi says to him, he says, I'll tell you the truth. These scrolls are the only genuine thing I have in this temple, and I want to make sure they stay that way. Nobody ever dared to change that text. No matter where you go. I don't advise it, but go into Reform Temple and open up the ark and look at this. And maybe, I don't know if they bring a sofer there to fix it all the time. It's the same thing wherever we go. I go to every hotel I go to, and I've traveled a lot. And the first thing I do, I open up the drawer there to find the Gideon Bible. And except in Vienna, the first time and only time in my life, it was in German, but I saw the Bible didn't have the Old Testament, didn't have the Tanakh. But there they have the Tanakh, and then they have whatever they added to it. But the whole world lives by this directive. The whole world knows that at Har Sinai, the Torah was revealed to Klal Yisrael in a public form, and it was passed down accurately from generation to generation. And the Goyim who translated it, and who continue to publish it and translate this, the most published book in all of human history, the Bible, are constantly propagating and promoting
The same thing. Maimon Har Sinai, Yitzias Mitzrayim, Kriyas Yamsuf, everything.
No way. There's no way. There exists the sense of the purpose of creation, and it's known to the extent that we can be confident that we actually know the purpose for creation, and therefore we can, in fact, find true happiness. But I want to take it a step further, too. If happiness is about validation, validation is about purpose, but validation is about something else. Validation is feeling good about myself. Okay? Let me now share with you for a moment why I feel that the world is such an unhappy place, besides the reason that they don't know what happiness is, and therefore they're searching for it and they can't find it. And the additional reason is as follows. We live in a world, I like to say that every city in the world, practically, I call a pleasure capital. It's the pleasure capital. I don't say it about the specific city that I'm in because people get sensitive and insulted. But we live in pleasure capitals, pleasure capitals. The pursuit of pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. In fact, 9 out of 10 people that you will ask them for a definition of happiness, they will say, happiness equals pleasure. But do you know something? Nothing can be further from the truth. Happiness unequals pleasure. Happiness is destroyed by the pursuit of pleasure. Why should that be? Can anybody explain that? How could it be that the pursuit of pleasure, pleasure, fun, enjoyment, thrill, all the stuff that our society is built on, that's the antithesis, the opposite. It brings to depression. It doesn't bring to happiness, it brings to unhappiness. It brings to misery. Why? Why should that be? It doesn't make sense. Having a good time, having a great time, having a blast. Wow. What's that? So therefore what? It doesn't last, so therefore it doesn't satisfy. But why does it bring to unhappiness?
There's always better.
There's always more, so you're never satisfied. So, but is that enough to bring unhappiness? I think there's a step beyond. I think you're right. I think there's even a step beyond that. What's that? Okay, so that's the same thing, that it's very temporary, and therefore it doesn't lead to permanent happiness. But I would contest that you're not even happy when it's going on. Again, let's go back, yes?
Because it's not real happiness, it's actually a purpose. If real happiness is having a good purpose, then obviously it's not real happiness because it's not real, you're not going by the definition of happiness.
Okay, it doesn't fit the definition of happiness. Let's take that step and take it one step further. The definition of happiness is validation, feeling good about yourself. Does the pursuit of pleasure make a person feel good about himself or bad about himself?
Good.
Ask anyone who's addicted to any pleasure. Ask anyone who can't control his tivus. Ask anyone who just must have a drink and must have a smoke and must have a drug and must have a thrill and must have a diversion and can't stop playing games on his cell phone and all of these things. Ask any of these people, do these activities make them feel good about themselves? Mm-hmm. No, you know why? Very simple. Because if I need this to be okay temporarily, then I have sent myself the message, I am worthless. I am not valid. I don't have any purpose. I don't have any meaning. I don't feel good about myself. Because I need this junk to go through the day. If I felt good about myself, I don't need anything to go through the day. I'm happy with myself. I feel good about myself. I'm okay. I'm good. So all of these things, the need, the dependency, and our society has become dependent on the pursuit of pleasure. As much as they claim they're pursuing happiness, unfortunately, in the name of happiness, they're really pursuing pleasure, which is the antithesis, the opposite of happiness. So because I need this, I need a drink. I can't get by without a drink. I don't know what the rabbi put in here, but if it's what I would like it to be, I can't get by without the drink. No, okay. You know, I can't get by without, I need the drink, I need the drink, I need the, 4 hours I haven't had a drink. 4 hours I haven't had a smoke. 4 hours I haven't had a thrill. I can't go on. That sends the message to me, I'm worthless. You don't feel good about yourself, you feel bad about yourself. You have to substitute all types of external invitations, external imposing or implanting external things into yourself in order to just get through the day.
They don't make, they send the opposite message. If I was worthy of myself, if I felt good about myself, if I appreciated my purpose in life, I wouldn't need this garbage. Those things that I need, I need. And they're only to help me to fulfill that purpose. So, therefore, we have a double problem in our society. We have not only the lack of a definition of what happiness is, we have a commitment to activities that undermine happiness. Undermine happiness. They substitute, they say, you need this, you need this, you need this, you can't get on. How can I manage? I must have this, I must have that, I must have the other thing. And I'm really sending myself a subtle message. I'm not worth very much, and I need all of this junk just to be able to survive. So we really have a world today of problems. On the other hand, a world of Torah, a life of Torah, a commitment to Torah, teaches something else. What is the purpose for which Hashem created the world? What's that? I can't hear.
Connection with
Hashem. Okay, but basically the David HaMelech described the purpose succinctly, and he said, "Olam Chesed Yiboneh." The world was created because Hashem wants to do Chesed. And the greatest Chesed is to connect us to Hashem. That's the greatest feeling. The most uplifting feeling. Imagine that. You know who my best friend is? The Creator. You know me and him? We're tight like this. We're inseparable. I patterned my life to be just like him. And he responds with a unique measure of love and appreciation because me and him were made of the same stuff. Now you look at me and say, what? Made of the same stuff? We can be. We're created B'Tselem Elokim in the image of God. And we can elevate ourselves higher and higher and higher and higher to higher levels of human development and human sensitivity and human depth and human perfection. And that's the purpose of creation. Chazal say, Lo'initno ha-mitzvos elo litzaref bo'enes ha-brios. Mitzvos are only given to refine human character. When we refine our character, we make ourselves more godly. When we make ourselves more godly, we connect with Hashem. So not only do I fulfill my purpose for being created, but I now have made myself godly. Now, if I'm godly, do I feel good about myself? And godliness is permanent. My goodness, when I achieve goodness, it's permanent. I'm there. I became a better person. I'm at that level. And that's real. And that's who I am. And that's validating. And that's osher. And that's happiness. And that's fulfillment. So I have the fulfillment of my purpose in life. And my purpose is the most uplifting feeling that exists. Now let me take this just one step further. According to this, in order really to feel good about oneself, one has to be focused on the good that they do. Okay? So let's say I do good, and that elevates me, because I did good, I become a more godly human being. But when I forget about the good, so I don't really enjoy that benefit, because I forgot about it. Okay, and that's pretty much similar to the pleasures of life. Even if I enjoyed something, but after it passes, it's gone, and I forgot about it. Now, it's true that if I asked you the question, what brings you a more pleasurable memory? The most delicious dinner that you had in the last month, or the most accomplished or amazing thing that I did to help somebody else? The chesed that I did, a mitzvah that I did. There's no question that the dinner doesn't bring any pleasure because it's gone, finished, it's over, there's nothing left, absolutely nothing left. It could be a memory of a pleasure, but it's certainly not a pleasure at all. On the other hand, the good deed that I did can give me a certain amount of pleasure now because I feel good, I think about it, I feel good. But someone once asked me the question, but that requires thinking about it. It requires thinking about it, and if you don't think about it, you won't feel good about it, right? That makes sense. So it's just, in a sense, in that sense, it's the same as the pleasure. It's not true. When I do something good, when I do something godly, you know what I do? I elevate myself. I was a 1 yesterday. I became a 2. I did more good. I became a 3. I became a 4. Now I'm a 5. Now, I forgot about the act that brought me to 5. But I remain a 5 for the rest of my life. The good feeling, the validation that I feel at having reached 5 remains with me even if I forget about what brought me there. I don't know what brought me there. I forgot. I did these acts. It's long gone and forgotten. But I have this good feeling about myself, which remains. Whereas the physical pleasure, not only even if I remember it, it doesn't do anything for me, there's no pleasure. It certainly didn't elevate me except maybe the waistline. But what it did do, I don't feel good about myself. There's nothing there. Even when I remember it, it's nothing. Here, even without remembering it, I elevated myself. I am now more godly. I am more valid. I feel more good about myself. And that good feeling, that sense of self, that sense of validation, that sense of feeling good about myself remains forever. So I think the upshot of this whole discussion is that we're all very fortunate in a world so confused, so cursed, with an endless and almost hopeless pursuit of happiness. Here we sit, here we stand, here we are, thousands of years from Avraham Avinu, from Maimon Har Sinai, from the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and still with the same power to find our sense of purpose in life, to find our sense of meaning, to find the ultimate validation, the validation in true purpose, and the validation in elevating and uplifting ourselves to become closer and closer and more likely, and more like HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, which is the ultimate good feeling that I feel about myself. I think we should all be very, very thankful. And maybe the words Ashreinu, Osher, happy, Matov Chelkeinu, Umanoim Goyroleinu, Umayofo Yerushoseinu, should be something that we should truly develop a sense of appreciation, and to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he has privileged us, that even though we sit here 2,000 years in Golus, having been oppressed and opposed by every power and every negative influence and every enemy imaginable, with blood-stained pages in our history, and yet we survive, and we're well, we still have our Torah, we're still committed, and we still have the formula for true happiness. Have a good Shabbos.